This is Roxanne Farwell with the Smoke Jumpers Oral History Project. I'm interviewing Mr. Art Flick. We are in the Anthropology Department at the University of Montana. It's July 22nd, 1984, and it's about noon. You ready?
Right.
Okay. Can you tell me how old you are?
I'm 54.
And where were you born?
Syracuse, New York.
Okay. When did you come to Missoula area?
Well, I first came out here in 1953 when I was accepted in the jumpers. That was the first I'd ever been west.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And can you kind of outline your background before you became a jumper?
Well, I'd gone through high school and always had a desire to go to West Point. So I, at the end of my senior year in high school, I went to a preparatory school in New York City. And at that time, my congressman didn't have any appointments for West Point, but he had one for Annapolis, so I took a competitive exam for that and got the highest grades on the exam and was the principal appointment for Annapolis and ultimately ended up going to the Naval Academy. And I was there 2 years and got hurt and had to drop out of the academy, had a head injury from playing. I was on the varsity soccer team. Mm-hmm. And it was an injury that I was a couple years getting over, so I couldn't go back to school until I got over my problems from the injury. And then I decided on a career in forestry, so I went to New York State Ranger School, which was a one-year semi-professional level school. And when I graduated from there, I went on down to Syracuse and decided to go on and get a full degree in forestry. And while I was there, I happened to see that movie, The Red Skies of Montana, and that piqued my curiosity and my interest. So there were 15 of us from our class here at Syracuse, the class 55, that applied to go to the jumper training school, and out of the 15, just two of us were accepted. Mm. I don't know how they picked the two guys, because on paper it seemed like we all looked pretty much alike, but I was selected along with a fellow named Hunt Hatch, and we came on out, drove out in my old 50 or 40 Chevrolet that I had, and Hatch liked it out here so well that he never went back to New York. He stayed out here and went to Idaho and got his degree there. So that was how I happened to get out here,
yeah,
to start with.
You remember anything on that application that you filled out?
No, the only thing that I thought that might have helped me was my Naval Academy background, that they knew I'd been subjected to discipline and would be in good physical condition and be able to take orders and function well.
Yeah.
I was always very physical in high school and in college, you know, played baseball and soccer and everything, so that may have helped me, I don't know.
What was your image of the smoke jumper? Was it pretty much just like the movie you saw?
Well, you know, just I was always kind of like to do new things and liked adventure, and it just appealed to that part of my personality that I thought I'd like to get out here and see the West and jump out of airplanes to fires, much to my parents' distress.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how they felt about that.
Yeah. Just one of those things you couldn't explain, just something I wanted to do or felt that I had to do it, and I'm real glad that I did it.
Yeah. So you came out in 53.
Mm-hmm. And I was with the early group that went through. I believe there were 18 of us, I think, in that early group.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent all my letters home to my parents, and I couldn't believe it when I read them over here about a month ago. And according to my letters, there were only 4 or 6 out of that 18 of us in that group that finished the training.
Oh.
Because of injuries and dropouts and like that.
Yeah.
And some of them went on and completed their training when the second group came in, which was a much larger group.
That would be the same season, but just
yeah, right. We came out in May. They let me out of school early. I took my exams early so I could come out with the early group. And as I say, there were 18 of us. And then with that group of 18, there were 12 Army Airborne Rangers, 10 Master Sergeants, and 2 Lieutenants that trained with us. And mm-hmm. We're learning timber jumping techniques, and I believe that was the first Army personnel that had ever trained with the jumpers. They were studying our chutes and techniques and mm-hmm. everything. So there were 18 of us, and 12 of them made 30 in the group.
Yeah.
So that was a story on that.
Was this at 9 Mile?
Yes, that was at 9 Mile.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the last year we trained at 9 Mile.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe the facilities you had there?
Well, the facilities there were pretty primitive. That was an old CCC camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going in the little office they had there the day that Hunt Hatch and I reported. And one of the Army boys had had gotten hurt the day before and he had his arm in a sling, and another fellow was in there, had a cast on his leg, and there were only four people in the building, and I thought, gee, here two of them are crippled, what am I getting into? Already two guys out of four are hurt. So, you know, I was a little apprehensive when I saw that. But we slept in barracks, wooden barracks on cots, and had a mess hall. And And I remember one of the things they had us do every morning before breakfast was go out and work on a wood pile. They had a big wood piler, and we'd have to go out and cut wood every morning, split wood, and do that for an hour before breakfast. And that was quite, I'd cut wood at home, so it was nothing new to me. And then we'd have breakfast, and then we'd have calisthenics, which I never understood why they had them right after breakfast. We'd go out and do an hour of calisthenics, and then we'd start our training, and I don't remember just what took place when. We had courses and everything and worked on the towers and the mock-ups and all that.
Yeah. But how long did that last?
I don't remember how long the training was. I'd have to look at my letters from home, but I'm sure it's documented however long they normally took to train.
Yeah.
But I remember the food there was just excellent. It was out of this world. They'd put a quart of milk in front of each person's place every meal, and we had huge steaks and all you wanted to eat. The food was wonderful. It was really great. And never ate any better in my life any place than we ate there.
Yeah. You need it for all that work.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ready for that first jump?
Well, the first jump was, I think naturally anyone's apprehensive on their first jump. We had all the training in the world that you should need to build your confidence. And I remember one of the things that I wrote home about was that the morning we were to make our first jump, we went down to the airstrip and they took off with a travel air with two of the instructors, and they went up and parachuted and came down and landed right in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave us a lot of confidence. We figured, oh, gee, I guess they can do it, we can do it. So, yeah, that first jump, and I remember just sitting in the doorway and thinking, boy, I want to do it, but it just seemed like something inside of you said you shouldn't do it. And you were having a fight with yourself. But I always figured it's easier to jump out than turn around and say to the guys, I can't do it. You know? So you know, we went out, and I was really pleased when I found out I was alive after I got the opening shock, and I was pretty excited. And I always had trouble doing my rolls when I hit the ground, and I remember I really messed up my first roll, and I was trying to impress Tom Milligan, who was one of them that selected the people to go to Yellowstone, and I really wanted to go to Yellowstone with the Park Service because they paid more money down there. You got overtime, and I was working my way through college and I needed the money, so I really wanted to get on a Yellowstone crew. So I wanted to do everything just perfect if I could, and I remembered on that first jump I got oscillating and I came in backwards, and I was planning on coming in frontwards and doing the regular over the shoulder roll, and I had to do a backwards roll, and I didn't do it all. I kind of stopped and then did the roll after the damage was already done, you know, so. That was my first jump. First jump wasn't so bad, but on the second jump, I'd gotten me real good friends with this fellow, Dave Halder, and they jumped alphabetically, and he and I jumped right together, and he landed it was an open area, but there was an anthill there, and he landed with one foot on the anthill and the other full foot hit at a level below that, and he got a fracture in his back, compound fracture of his back, and I remember him laying there and they took him to hospital, and so we went in that night to see him, and they had him stretched over a barrel-like arrangement, and we'd done these exercises to strengthen up our stomach muscles and our leg muscles, and they had him strapped over this barrel like that to stretch his muscles so they could get his back in the position they wanted to set it. And I remember he was strapped over this like a drum, and he was vomiting, and he was just in awful pain, and that really scared me. And so when we made our third jump, I remember there were several of us that were scared, I think, that were real good friends of Dave because we'd seen what happened to him. And I remember gripping the edge of the plane, and I jumped and I made it all right, but the next morning my fingertips were all bruised. And apparently I gripped the edge of the plane so hard that I bruised the ends of my fingers, and I didn't even realize it, you know. And another one of the boys threw up that morning in his face mask. He was just scared because Dave had gotten hurt and we were nervous, you know.
And
I remember that. But other than that, once we got over the fourth or fifth jump, then it got some more confidence again, and it got to be pretty exciting.
Yeah. How did the instructors treat you when things like that happened? It was obvious you were really nervous.
Well, they just constantly tried to instill confidence that, that you had the training and that those accidents like that were unavoidable. You just tried to miss things, but once in a while you were going to hit a rock or catch a dead stub or something, and you know, certainly no reflection on them or the training methods. It was just a natural fear that you'd have if somebody close to you gets hurt. Why, you naturally think more about that than if some stranger gets hurt, you know. So,
well, you'd been through some military training in Annapolis. How did the training at the smoke jumper at 9 Mile compare?
Well, it wasn't anywhere near as military oriented. It was a much more casual relationship between the instructors. No, there was no comparison other than the self-discipline that you had to go with. No, there was no Naval Academy, strictly a military thing, and you know, spit and polish, and this was very casual. And you dressed casually, and
did the military people that were with you in the training session, how did they react to the Forest Service?
Oh, they were real anxious to learn our techniques and just made the transition. They interfaced with us very well, and you know, it was as though they weren't even in the military. The lieutenants didn't order them around. They just were there to observe, and they were 12 really super guys. Yeah. They'd go to town with us on weekends, and you know, we'd have a few beers. And we had one fellow, one of the master sergeants, his name was Williams. He'd played in Red Foley's band prior to going in the military, and he was a real good guitar player, wonderful singer. Mm-hmm. So every weekend we'd go into town, and there was a bar there called the Sunshine Bar, and that was kind of our headquarters, and Chuck would always take his guitar, and we'd go in there and sing and have a great time. Yeah, yeah, they were a great bunch to be with.
Hmm. Well, what was it that they were trying to learn from you guys?
Well, their jumping was primarily in open areas, and we were jumping in timber, ultimately, and so they were learning timber jumping techniques, and what the type of equipment they used wasn't really very adaptable to jumping in the kind of situations we did, so they were studying our chutes and how to maneuver them and all that.
Yeah, you had more steerable chutes, I guess,
We had one chap with us, Chuck Viviano, who's being interviewed over there with the other girl, and he'll probably tell him a story about the sixth jump, which was our next to last training jump, and he sprained his ankle on the jump really bad. He really tore it up, and he knew if the instructors found out about it that he wouldn't be able to finish the course, and he only had to make one more jump, which was the next day. So when he hurt his foot, I went right over to him to see how he was, and he said, boy, I really messed up my ankle. And so we laced his boot up real tight, and this other fellow that was with us and I put our arms around him like we were all good buddies, and we were singing, and we got him across the field and got him in the truck and got back. And then we soaked it in there was a spring out back of camp, and went out, and I played soccer down at the Naval Academy, so I knew that the best thing to do for an ankle injury, contrary to what doctors might tell you, was to exercise it. So we soaked it in this real ice cold spring for quite a while, and then put his boot back on, laced it up tight, and we went to town that night and had a few beers and went to a dance, and he danced on it until the dance hall closed. And then the next morning we bought a pint of whiskey, and the next morning we got him all full of booze and got him back on the plane, and nobody knew anything different, and he jumped out and made his seventh jump, and then he acknowledged to him that his ankle hurt a little bit, but he had plenty of time for it to heal up. So he and I have been real close friends ever since then, because he said if that had been for me, he probably wouldn't have ever gotten through the training. But it's kind of funny.
You think that sort of thing happened frequently?
No. You build a real spirit of comradeship up among the jumpers, and you tried to help each other out. You know, he'd have done the same thing for me. Yeah. And, you know, it was a means to an end. He wanted to get through the training, and we wanted him to, because we wanted to jump with him, and he's a great guy. Another thing, he was from the East, and I was from the East, and we were the only two Eastern boys out here, and so we kind of gravitated towards each other, because they liked to pick on us, because we were Eastern dudes. And it's strange, we both got picked for the Yellowstone crew. Out of the four guys they picked, Chuck and I both got picked for Yellowstone, so we figured we showed them. but Eastern boys could do.
Okay, you say you got picked for Yellowstone. Where else could you have gone?
Well, Missoula or McCall or okay. Winthrop, Washington, they sent fellows all over.
But now, getting sent to Yellowstone, you worked for the Park Service?
Yes, worked okay. for the Park Service. And yeah, that was kind of an elite detail because mm-hmm. it was just a small group and you jumped all the fires. You didn't have a big waiting list like they were telling us over at the depot yesterday. They have a big list and you jumped, and then when you come in, they put you on the bottom of the list there. There were only four guys. We jumped two at a time, and when you came back, usually the other guys were out, so you were on the top of the list, and we'd just come back and go jump. They had, I think, 81 fires that year at Yellowstone and the Madison River Country and Teton area and around, so we were jumping just, I think they probably set some kind of a record for number of jumps that year, because it was a real hot year, and a lot of fires, a lot of lightning strikes, and so it was a real good detail, a real good duty.
Of the four of you, then you had a squad leader or something?
Tom Milligan, yeah. In fact, he was supposed to have been here for the mm-hmm. thing, but our whole crew was here for the reunion. Yeah, and the pilot, Jerry Wilson, who flew our plane, was supposed to be here, and he just got a contract to fly helicopters in the Olympics, so he couldn't be here, but we were all to be here.
Uh-huh.
Milligan's wife had surgery, and he couldn't come, so we would have had the whole crew here from Yellowstone.
Well, was that about it, the six of you out there? Or
there were six of us with the pilot, squad leader, and four jumpers.
Yeah. And who was the rigger?
I don't remember who rigged those chutes, whether they sent them back here to get rigged. I don't recall.
Yeah.
No, I don't recall. I know we didn't do them because we were all first-year jumpers and we couldn't rig our own chutes.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't remember who rigged them.
Hmm.
Yeah. We had couple unusual incidents down there. We had one, I remember there was a inspector coming out from Washington, some big shot, and he was going to come out and fly over and observe us in action, and we wanted to impress, you know, him for Milligan's sake. And so they were flying a patrol and they saw the smoke, so we circled it and we hadn't seen the lightning strike it, we just saw the smoke coming up. So Milligan said, good, we got a fire net. Bird from Washington will be here tomorrow and we can show him a real fire.
Mm-hmm.
So we parachuted down to it and got down to it, and it wasn't a fire at all. It was one of the geysers in a timbered area that these things periodically would give off these clouds of steam, and it looked just like smoke, and we parachuted down to put it out and there wasn't even any fire there. So we thought, gee whiz, what are we going to do? Milligan's going to be back tomorrow with this big shot from Washington, and we haven't got any fire to show him. So we said, heck, we'll build one. So we put a fire line around an area and cut a bunch of green boughs, and we cut this old snag down and set it on fire and got it burnt so it was burning good. And next morning we heard the plane coming with this inspector and Milligan coming. We torched her and set the thing on fire, and boy, we had a heck of a fire going. And we were there busy mopping it up. Of course, we had the fire line already around it, and it was no way it was going anywhere. The guy thought that was really great, and he gave Milligan an A+ on the inspection trip. So I thought that was kind of a riot.
Yeah. Remember the first fire?
Yeah, I remember my first fire. Again, I've got that in my diary. I can't tell you any particulars on it. Most of the fires we jumped there were just lightning strikes, and we'd actually go out and fly patrols and follow the storms and observe the strikes and then circle them, and if whatever the lightning hit ignited, then we'd be right there to jump on it.
Yeah.
So we did, they gave us permission because they were having so many fires to cut down on the time lag from when we went out to get back, that we flew patrols almost constantly to observe the, you know, we followed the storms right across Yellowstone as they came through until they got out of our area.
Yeah.
So I think that was a little unusual because usually they waited for a report to come in and then they'd call you. But lots of times we got on them right now and got them out and got back out to the road. And so I can remember in Yellowstone the frustration of getting out on the highway with our fire packs or if we stashed our pack, just getting out, and the tourists would have road jam blocks there, you know, from feeding the bear and doing all those kind of things, and we couldn't get through, and you'd blow the siren on the pickup, and they just, you know, they just would ignore you. And we had terrible times getting back, you know, especially when we knew there was another fire waiting for us, and it was frustrating to try to get back to West Yellowstone to go jump again.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have a fire that season that the four of you couldn't handle?
Yes, we flew out on two different ones that when we got there, they were just obviously too big for us, and one got away from the whole bunch of people they sent in there. I think it burned over 1,200 acres. Mm-hmm. They finally brought up a bunch of Indian firefighters from New Mexico on that one, but it was, by the time we got there, all four of us were going to jump on it, and it just was, you know, we knew we couldn't handle it, so we didn't jump.
Yeah.
But those were the only two that I remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I went out on one, well, it was in August, and one prior to that, it was a real hot day, and we got a call. There was a smoke observed up on this plateau, and again, I can't remember the name of it, but I've got it in my diary back home. And we normally didn't jump in midday because the air was, you know, temperatures were high and the air was thin, and you came down like a stone, and we were out flying patrol and observed this fire, and it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we normally would have just waited till night, but it was in an area where it could have really gotten away in a hurry, so we thought, well, we'll jump. And I remember the plateau was 9,500 feet, mm-hmm. and so we jumped from over 10,000. And boy, we came down just like a stone. And I remember I hit the ground and it just dazed me, it knocked me out. In fact, I can remember this hot, searing feeling going right up my rectum, like somebody taking a hot knife and it was kind of goofy for a few minutes, and I remember coming to, and they said they could see the dust when we hit the ground. We hit it so hard it would just make a cloud of dust. It was so dry, and so I got this from one of the letters I wrote back home that the pilot said that he never again would jump any of us that time of day. He didn't care if the whole forest burned up because he wasn't going to jeopardize his men for the fire. But we did jump that one in midday, and it was a bad one. But,
yeah.
But we got it out, but we really hit the ground awful hard. And so then it was the next jump after that when I got hurt. We were jumping in a meadow, and I remember there were a bunch of buffalo in it. Mm-hmm. And we never wanted to jump in a herd of buffalo, and so we took the plane and we circled around and dove right down at them. And I remember sitting in the door of the plane and hollering at the buffalo, and I got pictures of them, colored slides of them with their tails up over their back, just thundering out of the little meadow that they were in. So we wanted to chase them away so they wouldn't, you know, if we landed, come down the midst of them, the parachute, they might go bananas and run over somebody. So we had a little fun rodeoing them out of the field with the airplane. And then Don Heineke jumped first, and he came short of the jump spot. So he signaled to Milligan to move the jump spot over because it was more groundwind than he thought, and he just barely made it into this little opening. So when they dropped me, I'd have been all right, but I had a malfunction in my chute, and I free fell about 400 feet. Mm. And I remember trying to decide whether I could shake it loose or whether I'd have to cut loose and open my ground pack, my chest pack. And I dropped so far that I just was afraid that my chest pack wouldn't open. So I kept shaking my lines and trying to get my chute open. And it finally popped partially, and I had some lines over the top. Mm-hmm. They call it a line over. And so I was falling at a lot faster rate than I was supposed to. And I came to the edge of that field where I showed you that picture of my chute hanging in the tree. And I remember seeing there was three dead snags there, and they were, each one was a little higher than the other, and I got by the first two, and I hit that third one. I was oscillating, and I just swung, and I smashed right into the top of the thing, and I hit it, and it knocked me unconscious. It bent my face mask right in against my jaw, and it tore the sole off my white jump boot. That's how hard I hit it. Mm. And it snapped that socket in my ankle right in two. It popped it right in two, and it broke my big toe on my other foot and messed up my other toes and my shin. And it knocked me out, and it tipped the tree over on a slight angle. And I was just hanging there, and my partner there, Don Heineke, knew that I had this head injury at the Naval Academy, and he saw my face smash right into the tree, and he said that was the first thing that came into his mind. I got hit his head again, you know. Mm-hmm. And I finally came to, and I remember hearing the airplane, it was circling right over my head, and I thought I had a bee in my helmet, a bumblebee in my helmet. And I finally came to, and I, boy, my feet hurt. And I said, boy, I was mad because I needed the money for school, and I knew I was afraid I was all done jumping. So I came to, and Don hollered up to me, all right, and I had this thing was smashed in against my face so good I couldn't open my mouth to talk. Uh-huh. And I just nodded to him, I was all right, and then I was nervous, and I went to thread my letdown rope through my harness, and we'd done it time and time again. You could do it with your eyes closed. But somewhere I went wrong, and when I popped my quick release and my harness fell off, the rope was tangled around my shoulder, and I was hanging by my arm. So I finally got the darn thing freed up and came on down, and Don didn't dare try and climb the tree to help me because it was already tipping a little bit, and he was afraid if he came up and got out there with me that it would tip over and we'd both get messed up. So we signaled the plane that I had a leg injury, and they already had the rescue crews committed, so they just dropped us a note we'd have to get out by ourselves. So we fashioned a crutch out of a tree thing. We had cut it with a saw and made a couple crutches, and we looked at our map, and we were 3 miles from Yellowstone Lake, and it was getting, we jumped at 7 at night, so by the time we got all this straightened around, it was dark. So we went through the darkness, and we got about half a mile from the lake, and I just couldn't walk anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was walking on my right ankle, which was broken because my left foot hurt so bad from my toes that I thought that that's where my injury was, my serious injury. So I walked 2.5 miles on a broken socket, and finally I couldn't walk any farther, so Don carried me on out to the lake. I'll never forget it, because I weighed 165 and he weighed 155, and he carried me on his back on out there. And when I saw him at the reunion the first night there, Friday night, I said, Don Heineke, and he says, by gosh, Art, he said, last time I saw you, I was packing you out of the woods on my back. So we got out the Yellowstone Lake, and we built a great big fire. And of course, the plane had gotten back and told the ranger there at the lake that had an injured man, he'd be coming out to the lake, but they didn't know where.
Yeah.
So we built a great big fire. I mean, it was about 11 o'clock at night, and we heard the boat coming. They sent a boat with the ranger in it, and he picked me up and took me back to where there was a road, the ranger station, I guess. And then I went by pickup. I walked to the pickup, got in the pickup, and we went to Mammoth, Wyoming, to the hospital. And I was mad because they wouldn't let me walk in the hospital. They made me go in on a stretcher. And I just walked for near 3 miles. I can sure walk into this hospital. And they said, no, you can't walk on your foot. So they had a roving doctor. He went around every 3 days. And then he'd just been there that day and left. So I had to wait 2 more days till the doctor had made his rounds and came back. And came in, I was afraid my whatever was busted would start healing and that he'd have to break it again.
You know? Yeah.
But I can remember laying in the hospital there, and of course they had it in the papers. And I remember this one little boy coming to my room with his father, and his father came in to apologize, and he said, my son's always wanted to meet a real life smoke jumper. Do you care if he comes in? You know, so there's a little kid came in, and I was talking to him laying there. And then the other two jumpers had come in from their fire. They brought them out to join Heineke back in where I'd gotten hurt. And when that fire was over, they came out to Yellowstone Lake, and they had their fishing rods with them. They'd fastened them to the shovel handles. They knew I liked deep fish, so they caught some trout. And they came in the hospital, and they were all dirty and grubby from fighting the fire. And and they had these trout, and they put them on my nightstand and said, we brought you a little something. Nurse came in and said, what are those things, those stinking things doing around that nightstand, you know? So they cooked them up for me. They cooked it there in the hospital. They were really nice to me. And then when when I got released from the hospital, got a nice farewell party for me in the hospital, and down the basement, the nurses and everything, which was kind of nice. And so then I went back to West Yellowstone, and I was 100% disabled. I had casts on both legs, and we were having this real bad fire season, so I'd go out with them. I wasn't on the payroll anymore, but I was drawing compensation. So I'd go out with them and crawl around the plane on my hands and knees, and Milligan would drop the jumpers, and then he'd jump himself, and then I'd push the cargo out the door. So I did the cargo dropping without pay or anything for the rest of the season until I had to go back for college. Yeah. And had another interesting thing happen while I was on crutches. They had this bear, it was a rogue bear that had been just raising havoc in the park, and they tried to shoot it and they just never could get the thing. And they'd hunted it at night with lights with their fire trucks and everything, and they never couldn't get it. So we were coming back in from a fire this one afternoon, and we saw this bear, he was huge. And so when we landed, we drove right back to our cabin there at West Yellowstone, and there was one park ranger there who had a 300 Winchester Magnum rifle. And but he wasn't a hunter. He had this gun, and I don't know why he owned this rifle, but he had it. And we said, his name was Vern McKnight, he was a seasonal park ranger, and said, can we borrow your rifle? That bear's heading towards the river, and I think we can get him. And so Vern didn't hunt or anything, but he said, yeah, I've got three shells for the gun. So he drove the pickup and I went with him, and we drove over and drove in through the woods towards the river. It was an open ponderosa pine stand, and we saw the bear. So I got out and ran over towards him and kneeled down by a tree, and I shot and I missed him. And when I shot, I'd never shot the rifle before. It was stupid because I didn't even know where the thing was shooting, you know. So when I shot, the bear turned and started towards us. Mm-hmm. And I shot that time and I hit him. And he whirled around and he was biting at where the bullet went in him, and then I shot him with the last shell and killed him. And they had a big to-do about it there in the park, and somebody finally killed the bear, and they had pictures in the paper and everything. And this doctor that was treating me, you know, came around, and I busted my cast all up running around through the woods after this stupid bear. And I'd already been in and had two casts replaced because I'd go into town nights and have a few beers, and I loved to dance, and I'd dance. See? Because this one girl I was trying to cheat on, she liked to dance, and I didn't want to lose her by being a wallflower, so I'd go out and dance. And so this was the third time I'd been in the hospital to get my cast replaced, and this doctor saw the story in the paper, and he said, you break up those casts one more time, I'm going to disallow your disability payments. You know, he said, this is ridiculous. You're not doing anything we tell you to do. Mm-hmm. So we were in the plane. I had my fourth set of casts. We were in the plane. I was out dropping cargo, and I was trying to stand up to get over by the door to get this one fire pack, and the plane hit a air pocket, and it really threw me, and I broke my casts again. Or broke one of them, I guess it was. And I know I was scared to go back to the hospital to get it fixed, but I did. But I explained to him that I just took a spill, and so he put the fifth one on, and then I was all right until I got home. But that's what those pictures of that bear are. He was huge over there that I gave the other girl to look at. That was the bear that I shot.
Yeah.
So those were a few little different things that we had there in Yellowstone that might not have happened somewhere else.
Did you encounter a fair amount of wildlife when you were jumping and packing out?
And we had a cow moose put us up a tree one time. Mm-hmm. And in Yellowstone we had, we used to call them rogue buffalo. They were the old bulls that had been kind of pushed away from the herd by the younger bulls once they kind of outlived their usefulness, and they had real bad dispositions, and they warned us about them that they were very contrary and, you know, would charge you, for no reason at all.
Yeah.
So anytime we saw any of those when we were packing out, because you couldn't run very fast with a fire pack on your back, carrying 100 pounds out with you, so anytime we saw one, we'd make a great big wide detour around it. Mm-hmm. So we never had any real trouble with them. The mosquitoes bothered us more than anything. The mosquitoes in Yellowstone were just horrible that summer. And I can remember coming out with our fire packs on some little swampy flats, and just hordes of them would be around your head. And if you stop, this one guy I remember that was in there, they sent in just temporarily. Don Heineke had to go to ROTC summer camp for 2 weeks, so they sent a replacement in. And this kid, whenever we came out from a fire, he'd go real fast, and then he'd have to stop and rest. And then he'd go real fast and stop and rest. And we were going through one of those meadows that one day, and those mosquitoes just got after him something fierce. And I told him, I said, if you'd keep moving, they wouldn't, they wouldn't be after you so bad. But he'd just stop and sit there, and then they'd get all around him. But they were more of a pain in the neck than the wildlife was. We never had any problems with bear coming out or anything. Just that one cow moose we got between her and her calf, and we didn't see the calf. The grass was high, and we didn't even know the calf was there until after we climbed the tree. And she went back to the calf, and they trotted off. But she they can cover a lot of ground in a hurry, those moose.
Yeah, they're pretty big too.
Mm-hmm. I remember another thing about Yellowstone that was caused us quite a lot of consternation was that the maps that we had there were very inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And carrying those heavy packs, you know, you'd take a compass bearing and it would show there was a stream running in a given direction and that there'd be a trail on the other side of the stream. So you'd come to the stream and it would be running in the wrong direction. Or you'd come to where a trail was supposed to be and there wasn't any trail, but maybe you'd cross a trail on the other side of the stream and it showed it was on the far side and it would be on the mm-hmm. near side, so it really messed us up. And then you'd wonder if your compass was wrong. Mm-hmm. It was an overcast day and you couldn't see the sun to know which direction you were going, and it really caused us a lot of problems. We were talking about it with some other guys that jumped in Yellowstone. They had the same problem. In fact, they had gone in with one of the rangers to have him pack. Well, he'd gone in to pack out their stuff, and the ranger got messed up in his own ranger district because the maps were wrong.
Yeah.
You know, they were totally inaccurate. Huh. I don't know whether they've corrected that since or not, but, you know, I just couldn't believe they'd have maps where the drainages and the water courses were actually running in the opposite direction.
Yeah, you think they could figure that much out.
Yeah. So that was a thing that was unique to Yellowstone.
You have any real long packouts?
Yeah. We had one, I believe it was 17 miles, something like that.
Mm-hmm. That was carrying your fire packs the whole way?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we just carry them until we got to a trail where they could bring in their mule string or something, but that was how far we went to get cross lots to, was up on a plateau. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What were your feelings about the Forest Service there, how they felt about the smoke jumping operation?
Well, we were under the Park Service, and they held us in very high esteem. They were wonderful.
Yeah.
Really wonderful to us. They kind of gave us a free hand because I think Milligan had demonstrated that we were all pretty responsible. The only thing that we messed up on was that night we jumped on that geyser and didn't know it was a fire, I get that was a problem. But after that, we tried to get low enough. We had no door on the plane that you could smell the smoke. You know, so that's probably what we should have done there.
Yeah.
You know, but it just never dawned on us. Nobody had ever jumped on this geyser before.
Uh-huh.
And it was in an area where, you know, it was way back in. And like Old Faithful, they can pretty well count on when it's going to erupt. These things just maybe sleep for 5 years, then all of a sudden they steam for a half hour. You know?
Yeah.
That was kind of a strange deal.
Huh. That's been some real fantastic country.
Oh yeah.
To jump in.
Yeah.
So you jumped about 40 or so fires or something?
Well, I didn't, because once I got hurt, then I was all done. I had 13 jumps altogether.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How were the cargo drops? Did you enjoy doing that?
Well, I just one time when I had my glove on and I put my hand in the thing, and when I let it out the door, I stuck my fingers in it quite a ways and the printer pulled me out of the plane.
Yeah.
Lost my glove, but that was the only close call I had on doing that.
Were you tethered into the plane when you would make those cargo drops, or were you just standing in the plane?
So I just on my hands and knees in the door, hanging on, just pushing the stuff out.
Yeah. Yeah. So it would have been quite a problem if you'd gotten knocked out.
Yeah. But it was no big deal, you know, just everybody's trying to help everybody else out because they had a bad situation there in the park, and so we did what we had to do, and I wasn't in any hurry to get home. I didn't think I could drive with both my feet and cast anyway. Yeah. But I ended up, I did drive home with both my feet and cast. I had a manual transmission in my car and had a hand throttle on it, so I'd use my hand, and I headed home. I drove the car all the way back to New York, but just I could use my one foot on the clutch and the brake, and I worked the gas with my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I drove home. And I remember pulling in a gas station in Cleveland, and I got out, and the guy said, "You driving that car like that?" I said, "Yeah." Because I had to sit sideways in the seat because this leg was in the cast all the way up here, and so I worked the clutch and the brake with my left foot and worked the throttle with my right hand, and And like if I came to a stop sign or anything, I just kicked the car out of gear so it was in neutral, and then I'd work the brake till I stopped. And then if it was on a hill, I'd just pull emergency brake on and was ready to leave. I'd push the clutch in and shift it and pull out on the gas thing. And I got it, so I was pretty good at it.
What was the longest fire you had to work on?
Gee, I don't even remember that. It's been 31 years ago. No, but we got most of them out within a day after we dropped on them, and then get the line around them, and then we'd have to stay 24 hours after the last smoke to make sure that it was dead. Because they took a lot of pride in not ever having to go back. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, you better not have to go back. You know. So what we did, we always took our fishing rods and tied them to the shovel handle, and while you were going through this 24-hour waiting for a smoke period, why, for any streams nearby, why one of us would go fish while the other one watched the fire and babysat it. So that was kind of good duty.
That's great.
Yeah. But we didn't abuse it, you know. We'd get out as soon as we could, but smoke jumpers aren't the kind of people like to sit around, and so one guy could be busy doing something, and while the other one kept an eye out for smoke.
Huh. Other than the two fires that you said were too big for the four of you, were they all the other things that you guys could handle?
Yeah, they're pretty routine. There's lightning strikes mostly. You just saw down the snag with a cross cut and get a line around the thing. And yeah, the only fire we ever had got away from us was when we were at 9 Mile in training. Hmm. And after we got through with our fire behavior courses and everything, they took us up back at camp and they actually ignited an area, and then we had to put a fire line around it. Well, this day conditions were just right, and the darn thing got away from us, and we had an awful time with it. In fact, it was really embarrassing because it burned off quite an area, but we finally got it out, but it was sure more than a practice fire.
Yeah,
it turned into the real thing. And those pictures that I gave the other girl there, those fires burning and the trees crowning out and everything, that was taken right there that day that we had our practice fire. That thing just plumb really got away from us. I forget how many acres it burned. Seemed to me like about 40.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right in the timber.
Oh,
and we had our work cut out for us. And there's one picture there of the crew. When we got done, we took a picture and everybody was really dirty and tired. A little bit embarrassing for the instructors, you know, because they supposedly had the thing all under control and it just plumb got away from us.
I can't predict Mother Nature all that well.
Yeah. So I don't know whether they still have real practice situations or not at the new depot. I don't know whether they go back. But they had everything just as realistic as could be. And we get right out there and pound the ground.
So when you felt that everything in the training really did help you out.
Oh yeah, it was super training, really great. I've had a lot of respect for all the instructors and everybody. Never met one bad apple in the whole bunch. You know, they were just, everybody was great.
Yeah.
And then seeing them at the reunion here, I couldn't get over. You look at all these guys, there's 600 or 700 of them, and hardly a fat one in the bunch at this point in their life. You know.
Yeah.
I'll be 55 here pretty quick. I went out and ran that 10K race yesterday and just really enjoyed it. So, quite a remarkable group of people when you stop and think about it. They really are.
Yeah, everybody's emphasized how much they like the activity and the wilderness.
Yeah. You're seeing it at its best. You get back in the wilderness areas. I came back out the next year and tried to get in again, but the doctor wouldn't pass. I don't know if you heard my ankle snap here a minute ago, my ankle snaps all the time and doesn't hurt. Absolutely no discomfort or anything, but the doctor heard that and he said, "What was that noise?" And I said, "Oh, it's just my ankle. It pops like that all the time." And he said, "Well, it doesn't hurt." And I said, "No." He said, "You can't jump if your ankle's doing that." And I said, "Well, I played soccer in college, so can't I go back jumping?" He said, "No way." Mm-hmm. You know, he wouldn't let me. But I was really heartbroken. But I went up to Alaska and got a job up there working for the Forest Service. So actually, it was a blessing in disguise. So I got to go to Alaska. I might never have gotten up there. But I'd probably been jumping for years if I could have.
Do you have any other fires or any of the things about the base?
No, those were, I made a note here of the things that were a little unusual. That's about the only things that I can think of that were out of the ordinary, you know, that someone else wouldn't have covered.
Yeah. Let me turn over the tape here.
I end up getting a cold. I don't know why.
When you talked to other jumpers that were like stationed in Missoula and other places, did they have things that they told you that maybe pointed out how different it was at Yellowstone? Or
well, I think Yellowstone was like comparing when I was in the Navy being on a little destroyer or being on a battleship or a carrier.
Uh-huh.
It was a little more regimented and a little more strict, I imagine. We were pretty casual crew.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was because Milligan knew us and knew that we were responsible, and that if we told him we'd be a certain place, we'd be there. And it was a very casual thing. We hung around the hangar, we set up punching bags, and we just worked out, and we had a swimming hole up the road, and we'd go up and swim, and you know, it was good conditioning, and he knew where we were. If we said we're going up the swimming hole, that's where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was a fire call, he'd know right where we were, and we could get right out and get on it. But we didn't have much time to go swimming. Yeah, but it was I just loved it down there. I'm not one for bigness, and my children, my boy went in the Marine Corps because he liked a smaller outfit, more esprit de corps, this kind of thing, and I liked that. When I was in the Navy, I was on a smaller ship, and I don't like big regimented organizations, and I think you just probably have to have that more like in Missoula than you would in a little kind of outpost station.
Yeah. You said the pay was a little bit better.
It was my recollection that we got time and a half for anything over 8 hours or anything over 40 hours a week. But one of the other fellows was saying today that he thought we just got an additional amount per hour, but it didn't amount to like time and a half or double time or whatever. But I brought those contracts that I signed when I went to West Yellowstone, but it just gave the per annum rate of $1.64 an hour, and there wasn't any mention of overtime. But my pay slips that I gave the girl over there, you could probably divide it out and see how much I got. But yeah, it paid more.
Yeah.
Because Forest Service was straight time, no matter how many hours you worked, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons everybody wanted that Yellowstone assignment, because it was more bucks.
Yeah.
But getting hurt actually worked out financially to be a good thing for me, because I drew full compensation, 100% disability, for I don't know how many months after I went back east. And so while I was in college, I was drawing pay that I'd have been terminated when I left here to go home. And so actually, from the standpoint of school, it was beneficial that I got hurt, but it kind of cramped my style.
Yeah.
Yeah,
a little bit. What'd you do after, you went to college, and then you say you...
When I finished college, I went to the West Coast, got a job with the Forest Service, supposedly was going to work in Alaska, and then they had a funding shortage, and they cut out that project up there, so I ended up working in California in entomology and plant quarantine unit with a Dr. Kimmy, who was a pathologist, very well known. We'd met in Alaska on a fishing stream, and he just took to me, liked me, and so he offered me a job as soon as I was out of college. He said, "You be in California, you got a job." So I was there, and I got a job, and was working with him. Then I got drafted, and went to Fort Ord in California, took my basic, and put in for overseas, so I didn't want to hang around the States, I wanted to travel. So they sent me to Korea, and I probably one of the few people that liked Korea. I really enjoyed getting to know the people and traveling in the back country. It was off limits, and when I came back from Korea, went to work for the State Conservation Department as a forester. I worked my way up through with them, and then I finally got a job at Cornell. They lured me away from the state. I taught at Cornell for a year. Didn't like teaching, so went back to the state and worked my way up through to regional forester, and I was a regional forester for 7 years, office bound, getting fat and lazy and getting ulcers, and I said, "This isn't for me," so I resigned after I'd been regional forester. I was 48 when I took an early retirement, invested my rights, and I just work for myself now. Guiding hunters and growing Christmas trees and logging and selling firewood and fence posts and just do whatever I want to do.
How did your smoke jumping experience affect?
Well, I think the discipline always helps. Of course, I had discipline at home and then in the Naval Academy and then the, so it's just kind of a continuation of a philosophy that I've enjoyed all my life. And but it was, you know, certainly a wonderful experience, and I don't think anybody who was ever in a jumper didn't benefit by it, by becoming a better person.
Yeah. And all these people at the reunion that you see and thinking about yourself and the people you jumped with, what's common in all of you?
Well, I think one thing, fellows all went on and made something of themselves. Mm-hmm. This was, I was amazed to find what some of the guys have done with their lives and that they're all in still good physical condition. This yeah. just flabbergasted me that, you know, I've always taken a pride in how I can get around. I love to hunt. I come out here every fall hunting elk and deer and get back in the mountains, and my wife fortunately has gone along with it. She understands this need I have to fulfill, so there's no problem at home on it. But you know, the kind of person that makes a smoke jumper apparently is the kind of person that goes on in life and has those things that you need to do pretty well. And Hunt Hatch, the boy that came out with me when we first came out here, is a Trans World Airline pilot. Mm-hmm. Flies, he's a captain on a 727. Yeah. Has a big ranch in Idaho and a fishing boat in Alaska. I worked with him on his boat last summer, netting salmon for this whole summer. And, you know, he's just fantastically successful. Chuck Viviano was on our crew. He's a captain in Los Angeles Fire Department, has a whole unit all mm-hmm. of his own. And Don Heineke, the guy that packed me out on his back, he went on through college, and he's a horticulturist and very well respected in all over the United States. And Tommy Hodges, that came out with me the next year when I couldn't pass the physical, he works with IBM. He's got a very good job with IBM, finished college, and you know, the guys, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, what they've gone on and done with themselves.
You think that's the self-confidence that was instilled in you from being able to jump? Huh?
You being used to working hard, playing hard. Mm-hmm. I think the jumpers all play pretty hard, too. I know I used to. That's why I'd bust up my cast dancing when I couldn't wait till my legs got better. We'll get it done now.
Yeah. Huh. Anything else you'd like to add about?
Yeah, I really can't think of anything. Of course, I just jumped the 1 year, so my reservoir of stories isn't as full as many of the people that jumped a lot more than I did.
Well, everybody's had their own perspective, but it's interesting how everything's beginning to come together.
Yeah.
When I ask about, you know, mm-hmm. what the smoke jumper mm-hmm. experience was, or mm-hmm. or what you all have in common.
Mm-hmm.
Some really interesting.
Yeah. And we've maintained our friendships all these years. Now, Hunt Hatch, that boy that I come out with, I come out here every summer and river raft with him.
Yeah.
He's got his own rafts and everything, and I'm meeting him tomorrow, and we're going up and hike 31 miles over the mountains into the head of South Fork of the Flathead and raft down to Hungry Horse Reservoir. You know, and I live in New York, he lives in Idaho, but every year we get together.
Yeah.
Some years I've come out and hunted in the Selway with him for elk, and he's got his own mules, and we just pack in and we have a great time together. Mm-hmm. And Chuck Viviano, this fireman in LA, he calls me probably once a month, has ever since, you know, we were in the jumpers together. We keep in touch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Huh. Yeah, that's a pretty unique job to
bound
all of you together that way.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that binds you together is when you go out the door of an airplane together, you have to kind of rely on the other person, because if you get hurt,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're out there a long way from help, and he's the only one between you and help. So you build a pretty firm bond.
Yeah.
It's just natural, I guess. You know, so.
Well, if you don't have anything else,
I guess that'll do her.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be interviewed.